This is going to be part four of the Preterism Refutation series. And for our visitors who haven't been here for the previous parts of it, if you may not even know what preterism is, and that's okay if you don't, because we don't need to be keeping up with every heresy under the sun and know everything about them as long as we know the truth. But preterism is a belief and a teaching that all prophecy was fulfilled by 70 AD. And all prophecy, including the second coming of Christ, the resurrection, you know, of the just and the unjust on the last day, the final judgment when all stand before Christ's throne, and the, what's the other one? Final judgment and the destruction of the heavens and the earth. Those four things and everything else in the Bible, they teach, were all fulfilled by 70 AD. And that probably sounds crazy, because it is crazy. And you might think, how could anybody possibly believe such a thing? But there are verses in the Bible, and we've seen some of them already, and we'll see more of them as we go through this study, that can be twisted and wrested to point to that idea. It, of course, is false, and that is the purpose of this study, to go through and show the falsehood of that system. And it is making a comeback, as I said here, probably in the beginning of this series, thanks to the good old internet. You know, preterism has been around for a long time, probably since the 1500s, whenever that Jesuit guy came up with it. And then it had a resurgence in the 1800s when a guy named James Stuart Russell wrote a book called The Parousia. But then it kind of just, it didn't really go in much of anywhere until recently. And now people are getting interested in it again because of the internet. So anyway, this is part four. Last time, if you remember, we started into the Olivet Discourse. The Olivet Discourse was Jesus' prophecy in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, where he prophesied of the destruction of the temple and of his second coming and the end of the world. We made it about halfway through the Olivet Discourse last time, down to verse 30 in Matthew 24, and that's where we're going to pick up today. I'll read you verse 30, and then I'll make a couple of comments bringing you up to speed where we left off last time. In Matthew 24 and verse 30, it says, "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." So we looked at a couple of things last time. We noticed, first of all, the change in the pronouns as we go through the Olivet Discourse. Jesus used consistently ye and you and your before he got to verse 30. When he was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, the abomination of desolation, seeing Jerusalem compassed with armies, it was always ye, you, your, saying that the disciples themselves were going to see those things. But then, interestingly, when we get to verse 30 and he talks about himself coming in the clouds, he says, "And they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven." Then he switches to they, not the disciples themselves, but other people. Then we also looked at the fact that that verse starts out with "and then," because preterists would say that this is all just one long dissertation referring to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and that he's not referring to two different events. And they would say that in verse 30, when he says, "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven," that's happening right at 70 AD, right when all this is happening, then this happens. But I showed you that, number one, the definition of "then" can be and is the next thing in an order of events. And the order of events that we're looking at, here were two questions. When shall these things be? Which would be the destruction of the temple, when the disciples asked about the temple, the stones being thrown down. And what shall be the sign of thy coming in the end of the world, was their second question. In the order of those events, the next thing that happens after the destruction of Jerusalem is the coming of Christ, although there happens to be a big period of time in between those two events. And that period of time is actually found there in verse 29 when he talks about the powers of the heavens being shaken and the sun and moon being darkened and not giving her light. That was a process that began right after the destruction of Jerusalem, because it says immediately after the tribulation of those days. It began after that, and it continued on down to this day, because those words are symbolic of political upheaval and kingdoms falling and so on. And that kind of thing began to happen in 70 AD, went through the destruction of the Roman Empire, and many other empires rose and fall. That same thing has been happening. And then the next thing in the chain of events is Christ coming in the clouds. And that's pretty much where we left off. So Jesus said that the destruction of Jerusalem would be accompanied by signs, and they would be able to see certain things happening, and they would know that the destruction of Jerusalem was coming there in their own day. but no such warning signs will be given to allow men to know that the coming of Christ is imminent. And that's one of the big distinctions between these two events. And this is one of the reasons why we can know that two entirely separate events are being discussed here. Because one of the events is said to be preceded by signs. The other one is said that you won't know when it's going to happen. The second coming of Christ will happen, as it says in Matthew 24 and verse 44, in such an hour as ye think not. Right? There's not going to be some sign you say, oh, it's right around the corner now. I know it's this many years, this many days, this many months away. We don't know that. It comes in an hour that we think not. So if anybody thinks he knows when the second coming of Christ is going to be, I can pretty well guarantee you one time it's not going to be whenever that guy thinks it's going to be. We can know that because Jesus said nobody knows, including the angels and including the Son of God himself, nobody knows when the second coming is. Now, there would be signs, right, of the destruction of Jerusalem. That sign would be the armies compassing Jerusalem, Jesus said in Matthew or in Luke 21:20. There will be one sign, though, I'll correct myself, one sign of the second coming of Christ. But the sign is going to be Jesus himself coming in the clouds. That is the sign. And we read about that in verse 30. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. That's the sign. Jesus Christ himself appearing. So if you're looking for a sign, I guess you'll get the sign, but you'll get the sign at the exact moment that it's happening, which that sign doesn't do you a whole lot of good to prepare yourself, right? That's why we are supposed to do what? To watch and pray. Right? We're supposed to be ever ready because we don't know, and there will be no signs telling us that it's coming right up around the corner. At that time, the Lord himself is going to descend from heaven with a shout. There's your sign. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 16. 1 Thessalonians 4:16. Here's the sign. 1 Thessalonians 4:16. It says, for the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. He's going to descend with a shout, which means that it's going to be audible, that it's not going to be secret. The dispensationalist, the premillennialist, especially the dispensational brand of premillennialism, that's a big one, teaches that Christ comes back secretly and he raptures out the saints and nobody hears it, nobody sees it, like the Left Behind movies, right? There's just a pile of clothes laying on the ground and the guy is just gone. And that's not scriptural. It's going to be with a shout, with the trump of God. And I'll define those terms here in a moment. It's going to be with a great sound of a trumpet. Look at Matthew 24, verse 31. The same points that refute dispensationalism also refute preterism. Preterism and dispensationalism are the two heresies, or two of the heresies, that are taught from the Olivet Discourse. You have, as I, just by way of review, you have two faulty interpretations. One is the futurist interpretation, which puts the entire Olivet Discourse all into the future. So none of it referred to the destruction of Jerusalem. It all refers to the destruction of some third temple somewhere down the line. And then you have preterism, which says that it all happened in 70 AD. So it either all happens in the future or it all happened in the past. And the truth is, some of it happened in the past, some of it happens at the end of time. That's the truth. Look at Matthew 24 and verse 31. It says, and he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. I gave you an example of what the great sound would sound like when I about blew out my voice cords here a few weeks ago, so I won't do that again, trying to make the point. But anyway, it happens with the great sound of a trumpet, and that happens to be the last trump. Look at 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 52. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 52. This is speaking of the resurrection of the dead, which happens at this last day whenever Christ returns. It says, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. Okay, so we have the great sound of a trumpet and a shout. Now, I realize that these are complex words. They're difficult to understand. They're ambiguous. They're nebulous. Who really knows what a shout means? Who knows what a trumpet is? I can see how people would think they might be some silent secret event or some figurative event like the preterists say. So I'll just define them here so nobody is confused any longer. A sound is the sensation produced in the organs of hearing when the surrounding air is set in vibration in such a way as to affect these. Also, that which is or may be heard, the external object of audition, or the property of bodies by which this is produced. Okay, so when Jesus Christ comes back, the sound waves are going to start to vibrate really, really bad, and your eardrums are going to catch that vibration, and it's going to hurt, and you're going to realize something big is happening. Okay, that's what the definition is trying to tell us here. It is a great sound. It's not just a sound. It's a great sound. Having a high position in a scale of measurement or quantitative estimation. Now, I shouldn't have to define these terms, but there seems to be a lot of confusion on this topic. So there's going to be a great sound, a big, loud noise whenever Jesus returns. Okay? That didn't happen in 70 AD. There is no historical testimony that the trump of God sounded in 70 AD. And the trump of God is a real thing. And I will show you from the Bible, it's a real thing. And it makes really loud noises. So loud that people are saying, make it stop. They can't handle it. I'll give you the verses. But he says there that the trumpet shall sound. Now, let's see if this trumpet is one of these silent instruments or if it's a loud instrument. Trumpet is a musical wind instrument of bright, powerful, penetrating tone used from ancient times, especially for military or other signals. In modern times, also in the orchestra, it consists of a cylindrical or canonical tube, usually of metal, anciently also of horn or wood, straight or curved or bent upon itself, with a cup-shaped mouthpiece and a flaring bell. That's a trumpet. Sharp, penetrating, loud tone. So I'm not sure how, with those words, somebody could come to the conclusion it's either silent or it's figurative and it's not actually going to be some loud noise. Now, I mentioned that the trump of God is very loud, very perceptible with the ears, and now I'll give you the scripture that will prove that. Look at Hebrews chapter 12, Hebrews chapter 12, 18 through 21. I only know of one other place in history where the trump of God sounded, and it was on Mount Sinai. And this is what Paul refers to here in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 through 21. It says, "For ye are not come unto the mount that might be touched, and that burned with fire, nor unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet," he's referring to Mount Sinai when Israel was there receiving the law, "and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them any more, for they could not endure that which was commanded. And if so much as a beast touched the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with a dart. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake." That was a loud trumpet. Let's go back to Exodus 19 and read about that. Exodus 19, 16 through 19. Now, if we're going to study the Bible like we're supposed to and compare Scripture with Scripture, and we read about the great sound of a trumpet, the trump of God, it is called, then we would probably should look in the Bible and see the other places that the trump of God sounded and see what was it like. And here's what it was like. Exodus 19, 16 through 19. It says, "And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the nether part of the mount. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by a voice." So the trumpet got louder and louder and louder. That's the trump of God. The people were quaking. They were fearful. They wanted it to end. That's the trump of God. That's what's going to happen at the second coming of Christ. It's going to be unmistakable. I remember back before I was converted and I was probably some form of a dispensationalist, though I didn't even know what that word, I never even heard that word at that time. But I was fearful that I might be deceived by some false Christ, because I knew in the Bible that there would be false Christs that would come. And I thought, well, what if a false Christ comes pretending to be the real Christ, and I believe him, and I end up worshiping him or following him or something, and it's not the real one? And I talked to the guy that was my professor in school that ended up converting me to Sovereign Grace, and he explained the second coming to me, and he said, it's going to be unmistakable. So if some guy comes and you don't hear a deafening trumpet and you don't see him in the sky and, you know, all these things, and people aren't, you know, being slain left and right and angels and all that, then don't worry about it. It's not the real Christ. And so that was a comfort to me, because then I thought, okay, I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry about being deceived. Just look for the real one. So there's no evidence of any of this stuff happening in 70 AD. But there's more proof here from Matthew 24 and verse 30 that this idea that the second coming of Christ was in 70 AD. If you turn back there to Matthew 24:30, we're going to look at another section of that verse. Matthew 24 and verse 30. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. That says that all the tribes of the earth shall mourn. All of them. Right? This is not some localized event. This doesn't just say that the Jews in Jerusalem are going to mourn, like the preterists teach. This is all the tribes of the earth. And why would all the tribes of the earth mourn? Because Jesus Christ is coming back to judge all men. Right? He's not just coming back to judge the wicked Jews in Jerusalem. When he comes back the second time without sin unto salvation, he's coming back to judge all men. Look at 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 through 9. That's why all the tribes of the earth are going to mourn. Jesus was not welcomed when he came the first time, and he certainly is not going to be welcomed when he comes the second time. The first time he came as a humble servant. The next time he comes as the Lord of heaven, as a righteous judge. And men are going to be crying that the rocks fall on them. They're not going to want to see the face of the Son of God. 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 through 9. 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 through 9. It says, "Unto you who are troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels," which is precisely what Matthew 24 is talking about there, right? He mentions his angels in the next verse that we'll get to in a minute. "The Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power." And this destruction here, for with everlasting destruction, is the final judgment in the lake of fire. And we know this is all men, because if you look at Matthew 25, when all nations stand before Jesus Christ on his throne, and he has them separated as a shepherd separates the sheep, right hand, from the goats on the left hand, the goats all go into the lake of fire. So this is what this is speaking of here when Christ comes back to judge all men. That's why all the tribes of the earth mourn, because they're all going to get what's coming to them. This obviously cannot be referring to 70 AD. Though the preterists say that's referring to 70 AD, they take all these verses and say 70 AD. They stretch, they twist, they rest, they spiritualize, they figure, make everything a figure. Nothing's literal. It says in Revelation 1 and verse 7 that every eye shall see him. Revelation 1, 7. Not just the Jews in Jerusalem, but every eye shall see him. Revelation 1, 7 says, "Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all kindreds of the earth shall wail because of him." Even so, amen. There's every eye, and there's all kindreds of the earth, all families of the earth. They are all going to mourn, not just Jews in Jerusalem in 70 AD. And then Luke tells us in Luke 21, 34 through 35, that day is going to come as a snare upon all them that dwell on the face of the earth. Luke 21, verse 34 through 35. This is a parallel text with Matthew 24. Luke 21, like I said in the beginning of this series, even if you don't care about preterism, and the only reason I care about it is because I have to care about it, is because people bring the crap up to me and then I got to deal with it. But even if you don't care about preterism, it doesn't matter because you're learning the truth about the second coming. So it's good anyway. Luke 21, 34 through 35. And take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life. And so that day, that's the coming of Christ, that day come upon you unawares, for as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. All them, how could words be more plain? What else could that mean? All them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Now, does that sound like the confines of the walls of Jerusalem to you? No, obviously not. All men, everywhere, all kindreds, every eye, right? I'm actually have more to say on this later because I'm going to get to the objection that the tribes of the earth refer to the Israelite tribes. But I'm going to save that until the end. That's one of the objections that I'm going to cover, so we'll talk about that then. Then Jesus will gather all of his elect from the four winds of the heaven together. Matthew 24 and verse 31. Matthew 24, 31. So he appears in the heaven, in the clouds, with a great sound of a trumpet, and then he sends his angels, and they gather all the elect out of the earth. Matthew 24, 31. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Once again, the preterists have this as some localized event, but yet it's from one end of the earth unto the other, right? That he's going to gather his elect, not just saving his people out of Israel or something like that. This is going to be the resurrection, where all of God's elect are going to be caught up to meet Christ in the air, like we read about in 1 Thessalonians 4:16, and I'll read you verse 17 as well. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 16 and 17. It says, "For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel and the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord." That's what happens when the angels gather all the elect. They're caught up to meet the Lord in the air. The dead in Christ rise first, the resurrection happens first, and then we which are alive and remain, whoever's living at that time, will then be, their bodies will be changed, and they will be caught up together to be with the Lord. And this day, that day of the Lord, will be as unexpected as a thief in the night. And that's what Paul goes on to say in the next chapter, 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3. Which really matches up well with what Jesus said in the Olivet Discourse. 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3. It says, "But of the times and the seasons, brethren, ye have no need that I write unto you." The times and the seasons are the times and the seasons of the second coming, right? That's the context of what he's talking about there. So even the times and the seasons we don't know. It's not that we don't just know the day or the hour, the specific time. We don't even know the times or the seasons. We don't know when Christ is coming. We don't even know within a certain amount of years when he's coming. "For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord cometh as a thief in the night." How does a thief in the night come? Does he say, "Hey, I'm going to show up in 10 years. I'm going to show up tomorrow. I'm going to show up next month." He doesn't tell you when he's going to show up. You don't know the times or the seasons. You don't know the hour. He just shows up at a time when you don't expect him. That's how Christ is going to show up, as a thief in the night. "For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." It's at a time when they don't know it's happening. Everybody thinks that it's a wonderful time of peace and prosperity, and then Christ comes. For more information on that passage, you can reference the Olivet Discourse study that I did back a few years ago, part 3. I covered this section in probably more detail in some aspects anyway. Okay, now that takes us to the third part of the Olivet Discourse, beginning in verse 32, Matthew 24, 32 through 35. Matthew 24, 32 through 35. As I mentioned, must have been last Sunday, the Olivet Discourse is broken up into four major sections. You can break it up into smaller sections, but four major sections. And he's answering the two questions that were asked, when shall these things be, which is the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world. He's answering those two questions. In the first section, he answers the question of what's going to happen with the destruction of Jerusalem. Then he goes and he answers what's going to happen with the second coming. Then he goes and he answers when the destruction of Jerusalem is going to happen. And then in the fourth section, he answers when the second coming is going to happen. So as you go through this, you'll see what, and when, if you're paying attention to the grammar. And it's not all that easy. Once you have it pointed out to you, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But the first time you read it, it's not just as straightforward and easy as reading a children's storybook or something. So here's Matthew 24, 32 through 35. He says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." Now you can see how people could easily get confused on this passage, because right after he speaks of the second coming and him coming in the clouds, then he says, when you see all these things, know that it's near, even at the doors. This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. And you say, well, wait a minute, he just got done talking about the second coming. He's saying this is all going to happen within this generation. But he's not saying that. And I will show you very clearly that he's not saying that. He's not saying that the second coming of Christ was going to happen in that generation. And once you see it, it'll be abundantly obvious and clear to you if it's not already. He's not talking about, or he is talking about 70 AD in this passage. Like I said, he covers the what of both events, and now he's covering the when of the first event, the destruction of Jerusalem. He did that. He explained the what in verses 4 through 29 of Matthew 24. Now he's going to tell you when the temple would be destroyed. He shows us here that the destruction of the temple could be known, the timing of it could be known. He says there in verse 32, ye know, by way of that parable of the fig tree, ye know. And then he says in verse 33, ye know that it is near. So the parable of the fig tree is an example of seeing signs of something and knowing that's what's coming shortly thereafter. He's saying here, the destruction of Jerusalem is the same way. You will see some signs, and when you see those signs, just like when you see the leaves sprouting out on the fig tree, you're going to know the fruit's coming soon. This is a cause and effect relationship here. But contrarily, the time of the second coming, the end of the world, cannot be known. And I'm just going to read you some excerpts here of several verses. Verse 36, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man." Verse 39, "Knew not." Verse 42, "Ye know not what hour your Lord doth come." Verse 44, "Such an hour as ye think not." And verse 50, "A day that he is not aware of." You see here a major difference? Ye can know, he says, when he's discussing the destruction of Jerusalem. But when he's discussing the second coming, you don't know. You can't know. You see, there is a marked distinction between these two events here. Now, he says, he refers to it as these things there in verse 33 and 34. "So likewise, when you see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." These things, that two words there, are very important because that identifies what he's talking about. It is crucial to understand that and to remember that. I'd highlight that, I'd underline it, I'd do something. And then even better yet, make a note back there to verse 3, to Matthew 24, 3, because that's where we're going. Crucial to understand that. These things refer to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and I'll prove it to you by reading the first three verses of this chapter. Matthew 24, 1 through 3. It says, "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things?" See ye not all these things, the buildings of the temple? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And here's the question. This is the question that elicited the response of the Olivet Discourse. Here's the disciples' question. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? When shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? So there's two questions. When shall these things be? What are the these things? The destruction of the buildings of the temple. Right? He just said it. So these things are the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, with that in mind, we go back to verses 33 and 34, and let's read them now and see if this makes sense. So likewise, ye, when ye shall see all these things, the things that he described about the destruction of the temple, know that it is near even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. He's answering their question with the same exact words that they used. When shall these things be? He tells them, when shall these things be? Within this generation. So the temple in Jerusalem would be destroyed before that generation of Jews living in Jesus' day would pass away. That's at verse 34's teaching. There's a lot of misunderstanding with that verse, because if people assume that this is all a prophecy of the second coming of Christ in the future, then you have a problem, because Jesus said this generation shall not pass till all things be fulfilled. And how do you deal with that? Because he said this generation. He didn't say that generation. This generation. Well, what some people do is what they always do. Whenever the Bible condemns their position, what do? You condemn the Bible, right? You just change it. If the Bible doesn't fit your position, just change the Bible, right? In the Greek, it really means this. Have you ever heard that? That Greek word really means this. Well, if that Greek word really meant that, why didn't the King James translators translate that Greek word to say that? Why is it that you know more than the King James translators did? Didn't they know what the Greek word meant? How is it that us simpletons that have studied a little bit of Greek here or there, why do we know more than the King James translators? Think about that. It's ridiculous. But they changed the text. If you look in the NIV on that text, it does say generation, but then there's a little note there, and you look at the note and it says, or race. This race shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Nothing like correcting the text whenever the text condemns your doctrine. If you don't understand something, then pray to God for more understanding and study the Bible the way he said. Don't change the Bible to make it fit your current understanding. That doesn't make any sense. And I hate that. I see that all the time in books. Philip Morrow does that all the time. I like Philip Morrow. He wrote a good book on the Olivet Prophecy, the Olivet Discourse. But he does that. People do it all the time. Preterists do it a lot, too. I'm reading the Parousia right now, and he just corrects the King James anytime he needs to when it doesn't fit his doctrine. And really, this verse right here refutes two different heresies, because you have a heresy that says it's all in the future, and then you have a heresy that says that it's a dual fulfillment, that it refers to the second, that refers to the destruction of Jerusalem, and then it later on refers to the second coming of Christ. And both of those things are erroneous, because it says this generation, not that generation. This does not apply to some future generation and the previous generation. It refers to that generation back there. Doesn't say that generation referring to something else. He was referring to his own generation. And this all happened. Within 40 years of Jesus uttering those words, the temple in Jerusalem were destroyed within that generation. Some of those men living at that time witnessed that destruction of Jerusalem. That takes care of that section. You can look at part 4 of the Olivet Discourse study for more information on that if you're interested. And then that takes us to verses 36 through 51. I'll just go ahead and read that. Verse 36 through 51. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noe were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noe entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. There shall be two in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken, and the other left. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good men of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched, and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household, to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant, whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunkard, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. This passage refers to the second coming and the end of the world. So like I said, he first covered what would happen in the destruction of Jerusalem in verses 4 through 29. Verses 30 through 31, he covered what would happen at the second coming. Verses 32 through 35, he covered when the destruction of Jerusalem would happen within that generation. Now in verses 36 through 51, he covers when the second coming would happen. And when it would happen is, we don't know when it's going to happen. And that's what he's teaching here in this passage. So he finished telling his disciples, by way of that parable of the fig tree, that whenever they saw Jerusalem surrounded with armies, they would know that the destruction of the temple was near. Let's look at that passage. Let's look, first of all, in Matthew 24, 15 through 16. Matthew 24, 15 through 16. Here's how they would know that the destruction of Jerusalem was near. He says, When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Now, if you compare that with Luke 21 and verse 20, we see here that the abomination of desolation is defined as the armies surrounding Jerusalem, the Roman armies. Luke 21 and verse 20. He says, And when ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh, then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. Right? Same exact passage. Parallel passage. So we see there that the abomination of desolation is the Roman armies compassing Jerusalem and surrounding them, marching through the Holy Land. That's what it means when it says that they would stand in the holy place. They would be in the Holy Land. That's the holy place. It's not some idol being set up in the temple, in some third temple, like the dispensationalist pre-tribbers teach. He told them that those things were going to happen within that generation. We saw that in verse 34. Then he begins verse 36 with the contrasting conjunction, but. You notice that? So he teaches them there that they can know when Jerusalem will be destroyed, and it's going to happen within that generation. Then he opens up verse 36 with, but of that day an hour knoweth no man. So the contrasting conjunction, but, lets us know that he's switched gears here. He's no longer talking about the same thing that he was. He's talking about a different event. And not only do we know that because of but he switches from those days to that day. And we'll get to that in just a second. He'd spent most of the Olivet Discourse up to this point discussing those days. And we see that in verse 19, he says those days. In verse 20, he says those days twice. And in verse 29, he says after the tribulation of those days. So he refers to the destruction of Jerusalem and that time period as those days. Okay? Those days would precede the destruction of the city and the temple. He now returns to the second question in verse 3, which is, What shall be the sign of thy coming into the end of the world? Remember, they asked two questions. Now he goes back to the second question. He's totally finished with the first question. He's told them what and he's told them when. Now he's going to go back to the second question and answer the when. He goes on to say, But of that day, an hour, knoweth no man. Verse 36. That day. Now that day is very different from those days, right? Those days are plural. Those days refer to a period of time. That day refers to one day. See, there's something different here. He didn't say of those days, Or I'm sorry, he didn't say of those days, right? He said of that day. He didn't say, but of those days an hour knoweth no man. He didn't say that, did he? He didn't say of those days knoweth no man. He said of that day knoweth no man. Now, the preterists are aware of this argument. They're aware of that language there. But what they try to say is that the distinction being made here is not between two separate events. It's only the specific day and hour would not be known, but the general timing would. So what they're saying is that he's all of this is referring to 70 AD, but when he gets to verse 36, he's saying that like the specific day that Jerusalem falls, you're not going to know. You're going to know the general time, right, with these signs, but the specific day you're not going to know. But that is false. That's not true. Because Mark's account includes the general time as an unknown factor as well. The general time of the second coming is not known, as well as just the day. Mark 13 in verse 33. Mark 13:33. He says, take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. He just got done saying in verse 32, but of that day and that hour knoweth no man, know not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son but the Father. Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. Not just the day, you don't even know the time. You don't know the timing of the second coming. So the preterist argument there is false. Obviously, this can't refer to the destruction of Jerusalem, because the general time of that event would be obvious from the signs that preceded it. Right? When you see Jerusalem compassed with Roman armies, you can know that it's coming up pretty soon. Right? So the general time would be known. Now, there would be an extremely significant difference between the time of the destruction of the temple and the time of the second coming of Christ. The first would take place over many days, those days, like I said, about 3.5 years. And history tells us that those days were about 3.5 years. The Roman general Cestius surrounded Jerusalem in 66 AD. And this is historical fact. You can read this in Josephus in his History, Antiquity of the Jews, or Wars of the Jews. And it may be even recorded probably in Roman history, I suppose, as well, and probably in Tacitus, I think. But anyway, Josephus definitely records this. So 66, Cestius surrounds the city. And then for some reason, as Josephus said, for no reason in the world, Josephus didn't know what the reason was. We know what the reason was, because Jesus was giving his disciples a chance to get out of town. Josephus wasn't a believer. He didn't know that. But for some unknown reason to them, anyway, Cestius left. I don't know, it was to go fight some other war or something, but he just picked up and they all marched out. Now, there's two groups of Jews in the city. There are the Zealots, the ones that are rebelling against the Roman Empire, and then there are, well, probably three groups. The Zealots rebelling against the Roman Empire, the unbelieving Jews that aren't really with the Zealots and just wish that the Zealots would keep their mouths shut and just they could live there peaceably, and then you have believing Christians that are there too. Well, whenever Cestius left the city after it had been surrounded, the Christians remembered what Jesus said. When ye see Jerusalem compassed with armies, go to the mountains. And they left. They got out of there and they went. And I couldn't remember the name of the place last time and I still can't remember. I should have looked it up anyway, someplace up there in the mountains in Judea. Wish I could remember. Anyway, they left. And it wasn't long after that. I don't remember exactly how long. That the Roman general Titus, who was the son of the emperor, he comes back again with the armies and surrounds Jerusalem again, and then there was no escaping. And the conditions there were absolutely horrible, and I described that last time, where it was so bad that people were eating their own children, their own little babies. And it was prophesied back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, I think it was. Moses prophesied that that kind of thing would happen. If Israel turned their back on the Lord, they would have such affliction that they would be eating their own children. And that happened. You can read about it in Josephus. I've got the quotes in the Olivet Discourse study that we did here a few years ago. A woman, a delicate woman, ate her own baby. Dead bodies were piled so high. There was rivers and lakes of blood in the street. The court of the temple was just a big lake of blood. It was just absolutely horrible. I told you last time, whenever they would escape, if they were lucky enough to try to escape the city, to be spared from the zealots in the city, the Jews were the ones that killed most of the Jews. If they could get out, the Romans would crucify them, and they crucified so many of them, they ran out of trees to crucify them on, and they would crucify more than one on one tree. And then, I know I'm repeating myself, but whenever the Jews wanted to take their money with them, they would swallow the coins. And when the Romans found out about that, then they were disemboweling them whenever they got outside the gate to see if they had any money inside them. When Jesus said that there would be such affliction had not been since the world was and would never be, that's what he was talking about. So anyway, those days happen over a period, 3.5 years. That's a long time to be besieged in a city. You can imagine, if you're besieged for 3.5 years, imagine what kind of starvation and deprivation you're going to have there. Just imagine how horrible that would be. I don't think we can even fathom something like that. But the second coming would happen on a day, Matthew 24:50. On that day, Matthew 24:36. Right? Those days, a period of 3.5 years versus a day. Right? We're not talking about the same thing. The timing of the first could be known by signs, verse 33. The timing of the second could be known by nobody, verse 36. Nobody, including the Son of Man himself. So the second coming of Christ will be like it was in the days of Noah. This is what Jesus goes on to teach here in verses 37 through 38. In Noah's time, in Noah's day, men were going about their normal lives. They had no idea what was going to happen until the day it actually happened. They didn't know that the earth was going to be completely destroyed. They didn't know it until the day that Noah went into the ark. Matthew 24:37 through 38. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark. So they didn't know. And it's going to be exactly the same when Christ returns. Verse 39, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. So, in like manner, it's going to be just like it was then. Men are going to be eating, drinking, marrying, given in marriage. There will be still a few people marrying. Seems like we must be getting close to the end now because hardly anybody marries, and the only people that marry are the queers. But there will still be a few people marrying, Jesus told us. Marrying and giving in marriage, so shall it be in the coming of the Son of Man. How could this possibly describe the events associated with the horrors of the Jewish war? How could that description, I just told you what it was like in those 3.5 years inside the walls of Jerusalem, right? Lakes of blood, mountains of dead bodies, people being crucified everywhere, just like the most horrible conditions you can possibly imagine. Now, would you look at that and say, oh yeah, people are just marrying and giving in marriage and they're eating and drinking and enjoying life? No, not even close. That can't possibly be describing the destruction of Jerusalem or the days leading up to it. Life was not going on as usual. It was chaos and mayhem in those years preceding 70 AD. Not life as usual, like it will be at the second coming of Christ, right before it. When Jesus returns, it's going to be a time when men are saying peace and safety. Let's look at the verse we just read in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. Remember, this is referring to the day of the Lord that comes as a thief in the night. And he says in verse 3, 1 Thessalonians 5:3, for when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction shall come upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. Notice the pronouns again. They shall say peace and safety. Paul didn't say we shall say peace and safety. They shall say peace and safety, and sudden destruction comes upon them, not us. You know, we read in Revelation 20 that the camp of the saints at the end of time, at the last day, the camp of the saints is surrounded by the devil and his armies, right? The world will be saying peace and safety. The devil finally has the saints closed in. Everybody else is going to be saying peace and safety. The saints aren't going to be saying peace and safety. But then sudden destruction comes upon them. Fire from heaven falls and devours them all, we're told in Revelation 20. So thus it's going to be sudden and unexpected, just like it was in the days of Noah. Those men, I don't doubt, were saying something of the equivalent of peace and safety whenever Noah was building that ark. And they're drinking and they're having a good time and they're marrying and they're just having a good old time. Noah building that ark, and they're making fun of him and scoffing at him. And then Noah gets in that ark, and they're still having a party. And then sudden destruction. The fountains of the great deep break open. the windows of heaven open up and the rain comes down and the earth is destroyed, just like it'll be at the second coming of Christ. Prior to the second coming, the wicked and the righteous will dwell together until the last day when Christ returns to sever the wicked from the just. Let's look at Matthew 13, 49 through 50. Many of the same arguments that you can use to refute dispensationalism, pre-trib rapture, premillennialism, can also be used to refute preterism, and this is one of them. Matthew 13, 49 through 50. And I'll show you why this is significant in just a second. Matthew 13, 49 through 50. It says, so shall it be at the end of the world. Remember I told you the preterists like to change the words whenever they don't work for them? They change world to age, the end of the age. So do the new Bible translations, the NIV and the New American Standard and all those other ones. They change it to age. It doesn't say age, it says world. But of course, world doesn't work with preterism. The end of the world, that doesn't work. But end of the age does, end of the Jewish age, end of the Old Testament economy, the Old Covenant. But he says, so shall it be at the end of this world. The angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. So at the end of the world, right there at the last day, the angels come and they sever the wicked from the just, which tells us that the wicked and the just are living together right up until the last day. And this is exactly what happened in the flood of Noah, Matthew 24 and verse 39. And knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. So the same thing happened in Noah's day, right? Righteous and wicked all living together. And one day, Noah and his family go into the ark, and the flood comes and takes the wicked away. The wicked were removed, and the only thing that is left are the righteous. This did not happen in the destruction of Jerusalem, because in that, the righteous were delivered 3.5 years prior to Jerusalem being destroyed and the wicked being destroyed. Remember what I told you, after Cestius left, the Christians left and headed to the mountains? Well, the wicked and the righteous didn't dwell in Jerusalem until the end. Right? See, the second coming and the destruction of Jerusalem are entirely different events. This cannot be when Jesus returned, for in that day the righteous and the unrighteous will be working together, side by side. They'll even be sleeping together in the same bed up until the last moment. Look at Luke 17, 34 through 36. There's no way that these verses can be referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. Luke 17, 34 through 36. Luke here is referring to the day when the Son of Man is revealed, there in verse 30. And he says in verse 34, I tell you, in that night there shall be two men in one bed. The one shall be taken, and the other shall be left. Two women shall be grinding together. The one shall be taken, and the other left. Two men shall be in the field. The one shall be taken, and the other left. So people are going to be right together, in the field together, in bed together, working together at the mill, until the day whenever they're separated in one day. Can't be referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. Look at Matthew 13, 30 and 39. It's going to be the same way. Here Jesus prophesied in the end of the world. Matthew 13, 30 through 39. This is the parable of the wheat and the tares. And Jesus says, let both grow together until the harvest, and in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, and the reapers are the angels, he says later, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. The tares are taken away first. The wicked are taken away before the righteous. Look at verse 39. Here's the interpretation of the parable. The enemy that sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world. The reapers are the angels. As therefore the tares are gathered together and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them that do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who hath ears to hear, let him hear. Can't be referring to 70 AD. It didn't happen in 70 AD. 3.5 years between the saving of the righteous and the destruction of the wicked. When Christ comes back, it's the wicked are destroyed first and the righteous are saved in the same day. Very different. And I made this point the other day. The wicked are going to be taken away first at the second coming. Look at Matthew 24, 34, 39 through 41. This really is the death knell in the dispensational theory. The left behind idea is that Christ comes back secretly and takes the righteous out years ahead of time, 7 years or 3.5 years or something, and leaves the wicked. The Bible teaches he comes back and destroys the wicked first. They're the ones that get taken out first. Matthew 24, 39 through 41. He says, and knew not, referring to the flood of Noah, and knew not till the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. There shall be two, or there shall two be in the field. The one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. The one shall be taken and the other left. Watch ye therefore, ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. So in the flood of Noah, like I said, the wicked are taken away first. And that's what he says there. They knew not until the flood came and took them all away. The ones that were taken away in the flood were the wicked, right? They were taken away, and the righteous remained and were saved. He says, so shall it be whenever the Son of Man returns. The two in the field, one taken and the other left. See, the left behind books tell us the one that's taken is the righteous. He's taken up to meet the Lord. No, he says the wicked will be taken away first. The one that's taken is the wicked. They're taken first. They're destroyed. And as I explained the other day, it really makes sense to me. Because if you have, and I used to think this, that when Christ comes back on the last day, that the resurrection of the just and unjust does happen on the same day, but I thought he came back and he resurrected the righteous first, and then he has the war and he destroys all the wicked, and then he resurrects the wicked after he's destroyed them all. But you know, you have here, like it was in the day of Noah. So here's what makes more sense to me. Christ comes back and destroys the wicked with the brightness of his coming. That's what it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. So the first thing that happens, he appears and slays all the wicked. Fire comes down from heaven and destroys them all. All the wicked are dead. Then he resurrects everybody. He resurrects the righteous and the wicked. The righteous come to meet him in the clouds. And then the living righteous are caught up right after that, immediately after that in 1 Thessalonians 4. And the wicked are then taken to the final throne of judgment and they're all judged. And then that way you don't have to have 24 hours between the resurrections or several hours between the resurrections. You just have one resurrection all at the same time. He comes back and takes the wicked away first, destroys them. And so that seems to make a lot more sense to me. And that's what we have going on here. But this didn't happen, like I said, in the destruction of Jerusalem, where the righteous were delivered from Jerusalem years prior to the wicked being destroyed. So in 70 AD, here's another difference. God used the instrument of the Roman army to destroy the ungodly. But when Christ returns, he destroys the wicked himself. You see, this is a difference too. God was responsible for both destructions. But in 70 AD, it was him using men. We're told that the wicked are God's hand, they are God's sword in Psalm 17. But that's a little bit different than him coming back and personally doing it. And that's what we have here at the second coming. Remember 1 Thessalonians 4:16, the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout? The Lord's going to take it into his own hands. And this is exactly what happened during the days of Noah. If you look in 2 Peter 3, 10 through 12, the same thing happened at that time. The Lord himself used the natural course, you know, destroyed in an intervention in the natural course of this planet. He destroyed the wicked. And he's going to do the same thing on the last day. 2 Peter 3, 10 through 12. It says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up, seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. That's not referring to 70 AD. The preterists say it is. The elements being destroyed with fervent heat is referring to the destruction of the Jewish economy or something like that. Like, spiritualize it all away. That's not what it says. It's just like it was in the days of Noah, when the Lord comes back and destroys the planet. And that's exactly what happened. In the flood, the Lord came and destroyed the planet. Verses 3 through 7 of 2 Peter 3. Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. So just like the Lord destroyed the heaven, the earth with water, he's going to destroy the earth with fire. It was a physical, literal earth back then. It's going to be a physical, literal earth this time. That's what Peter is teaching there. Now, the destruction of the ungodly in Noah and Lot's days were utter and complete. None of the intended doom survived. You think about it, right? All the world was killed except for Noah and his seven family members. In Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his two daughters made it out, and all of the sinners of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. Utter and complete. It's going to be the same way when the Son of Man is revealed. Luke 17:30 says, even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. And he's speaking that right on the heels of Noah and Sodom and Gomorrah. The same way it was there, it's going to be at the second coming. None of the intended doomed are going to survive in the second coming of Christ. But in 70 AD, there were survivors of the doomed city, and they were led away captive into all nations. We read about that in Luke 21 and verse 24. Amen. Luke 21:24. You see, things that are different are not the same. The destruction of Jerusalem was different. Not all of the city perished in Jerusalem. Luke 21:24. Says, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down to the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles shall be fulfilled. So some of them are going to fall by the edge of the sword, but some of them are going to be led away captive into all nations, which means that there's going to be survivors of that destruction of Jerusalem. But not so at the coming of the Son of Man. It's going to be just like it was in Noah and Lot's day, where all of the wicked were destroyed. So once again, things that are different are not the same. These are two totally different events under consideration. Christ did not return in 70 AD. And I'm going to close with a quote from Philip Morrow, even though I just got done saying that he likes to correct the Bible. He is good when he's good. And this is from his book, The 70 Weeks and the Great Tribulation, page 262. He says, here is a great contrast. One event whereof the Lord was speaking was then close at hand. It was to happen within that generation, and it would be immediately preceded by a sign which his disciples could not fail to recognize. But the other event, his own coming, would be at a time unknown even to himself, and moreover, there should be no sign to apprise his people of its approach, for which reason he impressed it upon them that they were to watch at every season. Concerning the first event, he said, behold, I have foretold you all things. But of the second, he said, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. So that will sum up the Olivet Discourse. Speaking of two different events, one would happen within that generation, one would be preceded by signs, the other one would happen at a time that nobody knows, and there would be no sign for it. One was in those days, one is in that day. So there you have it. The Olivet Discourse is one of the favorites of the preterists because they really think that it teaches that Christ came back in 70 AD. But the interesting thing is, whenever you analyze it like we have and you pay close attention to the words and the grammar, it completely contradicts that idea, and it teaches that those two events are completely and entirely separate events. So I love it whenever you can take one of the favorite texts of a heretic and use it to prove that he's wrong. Thanks for listening, and we'll pick this up next week, Lord willing.